This is
Fight Disciples.
We are gathered here today
for the Fight Disciples UFC and boxing talk.
Tuesday night, we're up the top of the tower. It can mean only one thing. We are the Fight Disciples, and we are back with more of the very best stories about Merseyside fight sports. We've had a couple of great weeks with some smashing guests from the world of boxing, MMA, and over the last few years, I know we've had a lot of listeners online, certainly when we release it as a podcast internationally, saying, you know, being fascinated by the stories of the guests that we had in. Let me stop you right there. Pause for a second. Tonight's guest is going to blow everybody's mind. I'm telling you now, this is a guy I was desperate to get him in last summer, the reason for which I'll explain shortly. But unfortunately, I couldn't get hold of him then. He was tied up. I'm sure we'll come on to that as well. But I'm delighted today. Joining me in studio tonight is the one and only Billy Moore, author of the acclaimed memoir, A Prayer Before Dawn, My Nightmare in Thailand's Prisons, which most people will know by now was made into a major motion picture, starring Peaky Blinders Joe Cole. It was released at the Cannes Film Festival to much acclaim, and I mean rave reviews worldwide for obvious reasons when you see it. And it was finally released in the UK and the US last summer. I, for one, found it absolutely fascinating, absolutely harrowing, and I couldn't take my eyes off it. It's now one of my favourite films. So, first and foremost, Billy, welcome to the studio.
Yeah, thank you.
Really appreciate you coming in. The story itself, I've got to be honest, I haven't finished the book yet. I'm finding the book quite a tough read. The reasons being, just as we before we come on air then, Billy, we're a similar age. We're from a similar part of Liverpool. We're both from the South End. We both grew up as teenagers, you know, loving boxing and everything else and being obsessed with that sport. And yet, you know, I certainly wasn't a silver spoon. I didn't go to a posh school. I didn't go on your journey, of course. That's unique to you. But when I read about your life, and when I seen the picture, which obviously brings it all to, you know, to its really harrowing truth, it frightened the life out of me. It really did. It frightened the life out of me, and it made me look at my own situation and my own family and upbringing, and made me so much more appreciative. Your journey to spend as long as you did in Thailand, you know, in some of the worst conditions on the planet, you must look back now yourself and kind of think, you know, where was the moment when it all went wrong? How did I end up in that situation?
Yeah, I think I just wanted to escape, really. It was like I was living in Liverpool. I never really travelled and, you know, got invited to Thailand. And my friends showed me the idea of, like, you know, it was a great country to visit and, you know, it was tropical and, you know, I found myself going there and falling in love with the place pretty quick. You know, we enjoyed their sports of Muay Thai. Although I was boxing and I'd never competed in Thai fights, I jumped in the ring. You know, and I think when I look back and I wrote about it, it was more about, like, I was getting involved. I couldn't deal or cope with, like, emotional relationships. So, you know, you could put me in the ring and I could take punches all day and that kind of pain I could deal with, but the pain of, like, being rejected or told it was over, stuff like that kind of, like, crucified me.
Yeah.
So for me, I looked at it as, like, an escape, but you can only escape for so long.
Well, that's it. Ultimately, you were, you know, you say you left Liverpool, you were escaping your demons in Liverpool because you had drug problems and everything else. Yeah. And was it a fresh, when you first got to Thailand, was it like a fresh start? Obviously, I know you were working, did you work on the Rambo movie, one of the Rambo movies?
Yeah.
And you were teaching English, I'd read somewhere else. And
yeah, it was quite mad, really, because, you know, we only went over for 3 months. It was a backpacking holiday. And when the 3 months was finally coming to an end, my friend said, look, I'm going back. And I just decided that I was going to stay. I dropped a new language and learn a new culture and got involved in teaching. I know it's not the right thing to do, but I bought a bachelor's degree online, but I took a TEFL. I taught English as a foreign language, so I kind of did study, but I went down Kozan Road and bought a bachelor's degree just to kind of add to the profile of teaching. And it was quite, like, scary, you know what I mean? Because they put me in a class with 50 kids who were just I didn't know what to do. No lesson plans and nothing. And I just improvised and kind of just blended it, really, and got through it well. And then you know, it was about, I got introduced to Sylvester Stallone through a cast member of Coronation Street in a gym in Thailand. And I was offered a role as a stunt stand-in for Sylvester Stallone, which was like, he was my hero. I grew up watching Rocky. And,
of course.
You know, I think watching Rocky as a young kid kind of really motivated me. It was all that tune, you know, all the music and that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it gives you a little bit of a drive.
Even to this day, when that music comes on, you want to go to the gym.
Rise
or go
up.
For a run.
Yeah, that's it. It's so, it motivated me. So he was my hero in a big way, really. So I was grateful for the opportunity to work with the likes of Stallone. And I was teaching English and I was pretty good at the end. You know what I mean? I enjoyed it. And then I got involved in boxing of an evening.
Yeah.
Just to pay the bills. But it was also a way of...
Had you heard about Thai boxing before you went out there? You were fascinated to see what it was like?
I've never really heard about it. No, it was more... it was something I'd never kind of took an interest in. But when I got out there and I saw it, the first thing I thought when I was watching it, I was like, I wouldn't mind getting in the ring with one of these. And my mate said, don't get in the ring with one of these. Like, they'll just break your hips. They'll just smash you to pieces.
Those little skinny ties, they don't look like much, but...
Yeah, and the first fight he had, I jumped in the ring to impress some girl I'd met. While my mate wasn't there. And I got my ribs broken within the second round. And the insanity was, I went back for more. Like 6 weeks later, six weeks later when I felt a little bit better. And I kind of enjoyed the pain. I don't know if that makes any sense to anyone, but yeah, it was like getting it kind of like took away a lot of feelings that I was struggling with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At what point on that journey then did you take a backward step? At what point did it all start going wrong?
I think...
Because you're teaching English, you're working as an extra, you're Thai boxing overnight, which means you must have been clean living to an extent.
Yeah, I was in recovery. I wasn't using any drugs. I didn't smoke, I didn't drink. I changed my whole kind of lifestyle. I was eating well. I was training regular. And he had, a stable lifestyle at the same time. And I don't know, I just ended up meeting the wrong people. There's always relationships with me. If you tell me that you're going to make me life miserable for years to come, I'd probably fall in love with you immediately, you know what I mean? And that's probably what happened. And, I was emotionally underdeveloped and I couldn't cope with the feelings. And, when it ends and it becomes all doom and gloom and then demons seem to resurface.
Yeah.
Telling me it's a good idea to just block it all out with a drink and, take a drug and I fought them for quite some time and eventually it was like I just had me in a headlock and I just picked up and that was the demise. Then I just fell right into the grip of addiction pretty quick. Smoking crystal meth in Yabba and drugs I'd never even heard of, taking addiction to another level. It was quite, I don't just pick up a drink and go to boozer and then go home. Like it doesn't end.
Yeah.
There's something within me that just kind of just wants to self-destruct. And that's where now I've gained more awareness over the years. And I think to myself, it's about being vigilant and keeping on top of things, being aware that one's too many and a thousand's never enough for me. You know what I mean? In that sense.
Well, at what point did you wake up? Were you in the middle of this like drug coma and you came round in prison, or do you remember going to prison? Do you remember getting locked up and thinking, I'm going to end up in a Thai prison here, this is not going to end well?
I think I'd used that much that I was kind of blocked from any. I had the inability to feel, you know what I mean? I had the inability to kind of think straight or have any clarity. And when I got arrested, I was in a shell, it was dark, there was a lot of other people in there with shackles on their ankles, and it just looked grim and very austere. And I just woke up and I just felt really frightened, but acted tough at the same time, if you know what I mean. It was like I had to kind of like, I knew that I couldn't show any weakness. I struggled with the language barrier, so I couldn't tell anyone how I really felt, you know what I mean, which was hard. I think it was the loneliest I'd ever really felt. I was in this shell, just feeling so lonely, so isolated and separated from society. And I was thinking, what happened?
Yeah.
What happened? What did I do? And I knew, and the answer just came. It was simple. You just picked up. You picked up a drug, and this is the consequences. You know, there's no way. No easy way out when I do things like that.
Yeah, that was Chiang Mai prison first. And
Chiang, then... yeah, Chiang Mai, which held 4,000 inmates. And you know, I remember going to the prison and seeing these two big stone lions outside these massive gates. You know, loads of babble that I couldn't understand. You know, I was like, I didn't communicate with anyone because there was no point. I was marched in, had my picture taken, searched, put on a compound, and made to wash in this big trough with about another 100 inmates. The water was like filthy, and you know, there was a thick sheen of like, you know, dirt on the top of it, and it was freezing. And then we sat down, and we sat in groups of four eating a bowl of sticky rice and some kind of food that I couldn't even describe. It was just, it was horrible, you know what I mean? It smelled, and I wasn't really that hungry at the time. You know, it was only as the days and weeks went on that I kind of had to force myself to eat food.
Yeah.
It was quite horrible.
Was that, when you were in Chiang Mai prison, did you think then, this is hell on earth? And then you got moved over to the infamous Bangkok Hilton, yeah. And you thought, actually, that wasn't hell on earth. This is now hell on earth.
Yeah, I spent a year in Chiang Mai, you know, and I'm grateful for the time I spent there because it kind of, you know, it allowed me to join this boxing gym in there. You know, they were quite reluctant to, you know, let me join at first because I was very, I'd react a lot to everything. I'd always be fighting and I'd get in trouble and I'd be getting beaten up a lot.
Is this because of the language barrier, you think? Because you couldn't communicate with people?
Yeah, and when people were talking to me, I used to get paranoid and think, because it was like, you could tell it was venom in what they were saying, but I couldn't understand the words that were coming out the mouth. And the way they were looking, and I'd observe the body language, and I think he's taking a liberty him. And then I'd react, and then it'd be like 2, 3, 4 people attacking me. And then again, the insanity, I'd do it again the next day.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like, and it was only because this prison guard who kind of liked me said, look, you know, you're like the Oscar De La Hoya, this prison, all you're doing is fighting, you're going to end up dead. Why don't you join the boxing and get in the ring if you want to fight? And I thought about it, and I wasn't fit, and you know, I was smoking cigarettes, and I was still using drugs while I was in it, because I just didn't want to, I couldn't face reality, I had to escape somehow.
Of course.
You know, and it was, the shells were kind of hot and humid, and it was sardine formation, and we slept on a floor, and it was... You know, it was quite a shock to the system, but I got conditioned pretty quick to accept, you know, the life I was living.
Yeah. I mean, when you moved over to Long Prem, then were you? Do you remember thinking that's boxing gone? Because it sounds like boxing saved you a little bit there. But so when you got moved over to Long Prem to the Bangkok Hilton, did you know you'd be able to go on the boxing team over there as well, or?
I had no idea what to expect. I'd just been like warned not to behave the way I did whilst I was in Chiang Mai because they weren't so easy going, I believe, there in Klong Prem. There was a lot more inmates. There was 20,000 inmates because there was 3 prisons within the compound.
Is that like, that's like Thailand's version of like the maximum, that's the biggest one, that's where all the, you know, the serious criminals are, basically.
Yeah, and there was a lot more. There was a lot more foreign nationals there as well, like Iranians, Africans, Europeans. The one or two English guys that were there, plenty of Americans, and it was quite a diverse bunch of people there. Boxing, no gym, so I was gutted. The only way you could kind of get any kind of exercise was using a wooden brush pole with 2 tins of paint with concrete put in them, and it was all you could do, really. So I kind of just train on my own.
Just hearing it again now, again, the film's one of my favourite films, and just watching it back, I think that gets captured so well. You know, there's one scene where you get put into the Bangkok Hilton, and you're basically lying down next to a dead man who's dead, and you're supposed to sleep next to him and stuff.
Yeah.
Seeing that kind of stuff, you know, you must have thought to yourself, what have I done to deserve this? Do you know what I mean? But it was bad choices in life, but it does couldn't get any worse than that.
No, I think when I went in and this guy wasn't moving, and I was looking around and trying to get everyone's attention. Look, and they were just no problem.
Yeah,
he'll move him in a couple of days. They've got like, I don't know why, but they have a lot of Thaiologies, and when they do that, they just lock down. You know what I mean? So they just left him there. There was the only space available as a sleep between this guy and a ladyboy called Tiffany, who spoke pidgin English, and helped me a lot, to be honest. I remember just lying there the first night. I wasn't even lying. I was just like sort of like leaning against this wall, just thinking. I couldn't sleep all night, and I was just looking around, and it was just like a mass grave, and I was thinking, oh my God, you know, where's the bed?
Yeah.
Where's your bowl? You know, where's your cutlery? Nothing. It was just, you're in there and you've got, and I was saying, how come these have got little mattresses? And he said, you've got to buy blankets and then you've got to pay someone to sew them together, you know, and you make a kind of like a little thin mattress, and, you know, that'll be your bed, and make sure you take it with you everywhere you go because it'll get stolen. And it was like, what, you've got to walk around constantly and hide your bed? It was like, you know, and the biggest problem he had was like, I'd come off a motorbike in Lao prior to getting arrested. So he had this injury, which is a rupture in my left side. And I was in terrible pain with it. You know, and I was kind of manipulating the medics as well for more drugs. You know, just anything, give us anything. But I did need these, and they were trying to sell me own medication. And I had no finances at the time. And I remember, like, just kicking off. And they were just like, go away, and I wouldn't. And the consequences were I was fighting with one of the medics, and I was getting beat up again, you know what I mean? So that was within 2 days of being there. And it kind of happened. It was apparent in my life that was happening quite regular.
Yeah.
You know, it was, I became like a rebel without a cause. I like to kind of defend the underdog, and I'd seen a few foreigners bullying a couple of old foreigners who I shared a shell with, and you know, and I took it upon myself to front them over it, and you know, and that didn't end well either. You know, kind of get myself mixed up in all these crazy situations, you know what I mean? It's just nothing to, you know, people go, look, it's got nothing to do with you, just forget about it, you know what I mean? But it just, I don't know, I think growing up as a kid and being subjected to being bullied was like, nah, I'm not having it, you know, it's not nice, it's not a nice feeling, so, yeah, it was quite difficult.
You're listening to Fight Disciples with Billy Moore in studio. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back after the break.
You're listening to the Fight Disciples podcast.
Welcome back to Fight Disciples on Radio City Talk. I'm your host, Nick Pete. Delighted to say Billy Moore still joins me in the studio. If you missed the first part of the show, believe you me, you need to go back, listen to it on the podcast, because we are now in the Bangkok Hilton. And at this stage, Billy, you know, reality checks obviously kicked in. This is your proper sentence now, I guess. That's where you're going to serve your proper part of your sentence. Thai boxing's been taken away from you. At what point were you able to get back towards that, and at what point did you kind of, I don't know, in that environment, do you have to kind of prove yourself in your cell, if you like, with your cellmates, to kind of go, you know, don't pick on me, don't bully me or whatever, this is my journey? And when, at what point did they let you get on with it and let you get back to the Thai boxing?
I think the point that they let me get on with it is at the beginning of my sentence. It was quite volatile, and I was quite angry, and I was quite involved in a lot of fights, and people were like a little bit more wary of me, in the sense of like, you know, they're calling me like Farang Ba, which means crazy foreigner, you know what I mean? It was like I had this way of just like not caring, you know. I sort of lost the will to live, and I didn't care about whether I was gonna end up dead or not at some point. And
did you think you'd die in there?
I did.
Yeah.
I did, I really did at one stage. I remember like wanting to end it. I was that depressed, and things was really grim, and I had no letters off anyone. No one knew where I was. I was too embarrassed and too ashamed of contacting my family, and I didn't want to put them through anyway. And I remember asking this Thai guy in a shell, and I was locked in this shell on the fifth floor in Chiang Mai. It was death row, and it was like a place where they put the most violent inmates, and put me in there for punishment for 3 months in shackles. And I was thinking, like, I can't cope with this, you know what I mean? This is just, these are all getting, like, executed, and I've got this little sentence compared to what they're going through. And I asked him, could this guy, would he sell me his laces? And he asked me why, and I said, I just want to go and hang myself. That was it. You know, I just want to end it. And he said, you can't do that. It's against the rules. Oh, what do you mean it's against the rules? He said, well, what happens is, collectively as a shell, we'll get punished. And I think that was the first selfless act I kind of, like, managed to understand and go, you know, well, you know what, fair enough. You know, that's not going to happen. And I got through that, and I'm glad, to be honest. And it was like, it was only when I got introduced to the boxing that I started to feel a little bit more confidence, and my self-esteem started to build up again. And there was a bit of unity with the boxers, because at first they were a little bit like standoffish with me. Mm. Nobody speaks to me. They just look at me, and I'd be shitting on my own, and they'd all be training. And I'd be training on my own. And then as time went on, we started to engage and communicate, and I started to learn a bit more Thai until I became fluent in it. And we just enjoyed that kind of unity. And
like any, could have been in back in the Gemini.
Yeah, it could have been back in, you know, they see me as part of their team. They even moved me into their shell, and it was quite nice to be accepted. Because yeah, that's all I think I'd ever wanted to be, was accepted. I was just drifting through society with the wind blowing through my shoulder, wondering what, you know, what it was all about, and, you know, where, what it was meant to be, and trying to ask that question of, like, why was we even here? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Especially when you're in that situation as well. Going,
yeah.
How can a lad who was born in South Liverpool end up in the one of the most notorious jails in the planet, in Thailand? Who painted this journey, you know? Are you a religious person? Have you ever been religious during your life?
No, I was a Catholic. You know, I think just growing up, we were Catholics and we had to do the Holy Communion and stuff. I've never a church goer. And people ask me sometimes, well, why is the title of the book A Prayer Before Dawn? Is it kind of religious orientated? And I went, well, no, not really. When I first went to Bangkok, I was put in a shell with 70 guys and I couldn't sleep. And every morning, about half past 4 or 5 o'clock, you'd hear, you know, the Islamic call to prayer, the Fajr.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like thousands of inmates who were there that were Muslim. And then 15 minutes after that, there'd be the Buddhist prayer. And I was like, wow. And then the doors was open and you'd be going out into the gates of hell, you know what I mean? It was like everyone was praying. And then it was just a big violent kind of environment that you had to kind of fend in, really.
You must have, at some stage, looked at all those religions that have been around it. You must have looked at the Muslim faith or the Buddhist faith, and obviously even questioned Christianity or whatever.
Yeah, well, we had these missionaries, which, you know, I'm really grateful for turning up and visiting, because they used to buy food and they'd come twice a week, and I remember them trying to, like, talk about Jesus and stuff like that, and I was like, what? Do you believe in Jesus? I said, I'll believe in ghouls, goblins, even fairy tales, if you just keep coming. You know what I mean? You know, I'll say yes to anything because you're supplying me with food. And I tried a bit of Buddhism. That didn't kind of pan out too well because I couldn't sit with myself. It was all about, like, being serene and kind of just not thinking and being cool. And I was like a lazy band. I was all over the place. And then when I got to Bangkok, I was really hungry and I was in the depths of despair, and I was using drugs and I couldn't stop. And, you know, because I kind of fell back into addiction when they took me away from the boxing.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, I just got a little bit frightened. Someone offered me a shot and I took it, and I was back in it again. And I got threatened with a syringe full of blood by this gang of Thai inmates called samurais. He was just covered head to toe in tattoos, and I was in debt to them, and they were threatening me with rape and murder and stuff like that. And I got clean again. I just thought, you know what, I begged these missionaries to help them pay this debt, and he did, you know, which I'm grateful for. And then I had nothing then. He said, that's it, we're washing our hands of you in a sense of paying for your drug habit, you know what I mean? So you need to kind of, like, wake up. And I did. And I'd walk around this compound, which was huge, and I'd see these Muslim guys just eating this food, and I'd feel really envious, and I'd be looking, you know, because I was hungry. Mm-hmm. And I was sick of it. It was like eating flip-flops and sticky rice all day long, and it just stunk. And they invited me one day to eat with them.
So were they given different types of food because of their religion?
They seem to kind of have a little bit of money and kind of be able to buy the beef and the fish and the chicken and all the great gear, where like we were like living on the United Nations kind of handouts, which was like slops. And the Africans would deal all the food out and rub all the chicken anyway. So you'd end up with water and a ball of sticky rice, which, you know, and it was so you'd go hungry. So they were managing to eat well. And when they invited me to eat with them, I was like, I said, sounds, yeah. So I sat there and I thought, this is a graft, I'm on. Yeah. I'll just be here every day, just having a little bit of food with these. I said, I'll come back tomorrow if that's all right. He went, look, my friend, only Muslim brothers really eat here.
Sign me up.
Yeah, so I just put a sarong on and a skull cap and called myself Yusuf Muhammad for about a year. And all the foreigners were laughing at me because they knew I was blagging it. You know what I mean? But then what they did then is they said, look, now you're a Muslim brother, you're going to have to move into our cell and pray with us. So I thought, oh, for a bit of food, I might as well. You know, I didn't realise they were going to be getting me up at 3 a.m. and all kinds of crazy hours. But, you know, it was what I did see it as, like, it was sort of like collectively as a group again. There was that unity, you know, and I couldn't understand any of the language in Arabic, and I couldn't kind of understand what he was even saying, but it just kept me sane.
Yeah.
You know, there was that unity, and I felt safe again in numbers, because I'd always separate myself and just be one of those loners who'd isolate.
Back to the Thai boxing then. What was the point of the prison having boxing? Was it just purely for recreation? Because, you know, obviously you were having fights. Are they competitive fights, or were they against other parts of the prison?
No, they were. It was for competitions. The prison highly regarded Muay Thai boxing, and they'd have competitions with other prisons. And I became a novelty in a sense. You know, I was the only white foreigner that had ever kind of had the courage to get in the ring and box. And I remember the first fight that they put me in with this guy who just hated foreigners, and he used to call me Aichwai. I was like, what's he saying here? He's calling you a buffalo. It's like the lowest insults in Thailand. And I was like, well, I've been called worse. You know what I mean?
Exactly, so, yeah. There's my new nickname, yeah, the White Buffalo. Let's do it.
The White Buffalo. I'm all day with that one. So it was for competitions and Thai New Year's and holidays. They'd set up this big boxing ring, and, you know, they'd have a massive crowd. All inmates, by the way. You know what I mean? And have the guards in the front. So yeah. They're all gambling around, stuff like that.
Did that help you as well? Obviously, you're part of the boxing team now. You know, you're living with them and everything else. But did that give you a certain amount of, like, kudos with the rest of the prisoners as well? Because you were representing the prison, representing them.
Yeah. It was... They were backing me, which was good. You know what I mean? People were betting on me to win.
Right.
You know, as before, I was just like, he's just a no-oper. You know what I mean? He's a drug addict. He's always in trouble. He's always in shackles in the cells upstairs, and now I'd got me head together. I kind of like and I was fit and I was fighting. You know, they were favouring me in a sense. You know what I mean, which was nice. So I felt a little bit elevated in my own environment. Then
how many fights do you reckon you had in there?
I must have had about 12, easy.
Yeah.
In the 3 years.
How did you get on?
I think the first couple I'd done really well, and then, you know, when it was putting, as it was getting, they were getting more extreme.
Yeah.
I found it a bit more hard, you know what I mean? I lost a good few, and, you know, there was a balance, you know what I mean? I'd like to say I won them all, and I knocked them all out, but I'd just be selling.
That's not the real world.
No, it's not. And when I wrote about this story, I thought, you know what, I've read books where you get people telling you, like, you know, what a great ego they've got, and there's no humility, and they're knocking this one out, and they're banging that one, and they're bending prison doors, and I'm thinking, you know, it never happened like that for me. I got it, and I saw stars, you know what I mean? Sometimes I was on the floor getting kicked everywhere, so, you know, and that was the biggest kind of, I had to have the courage to be honest, because I wanted to write about, I wanted to start, like, inventing.
Of course.
Like, I want to be an hero, and the reality was, I wasn't, you know what I mean? It was tough, and, you know, I done my best, and, you know, stood my ground. I never got knocked out, which I'm proud of. You know what I mean? I never got stopped, which was another achievement. You know, I lost a few, but I won more than I lost. So
did ultimately Thai boxing save your life, you think?
It did. Yeah, I think in a big way, because if it kept on doing what I was doing, I would have been dead. You know, I'd witnessed and I'd been subjected to violence, and you know, seeing people getting murdered in front of me and nothing happening. You know, they don't value life.
Yeah.
In Thailand at all.
That's the prisoners and the guards.
The prisoners and the guards. It's you know, people were getting arrested for murder and getting like 2-3 year sentences. You know, people were getting there for a few bits of drugs and getting the death sentence. It was quite bizarre. Mm. You know, if you killed an inmate within the prison, you were expected to get a 4-year sentence. That's nothing. You know what I mean? And you know, if you want to take someone's life and serve that sentence, then you will.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, it's an absolutely frightening situation. Stick with us. You listen to Fight Disciples on Radio City Talk. I'd like to say Billy Moore, author of the acclaimed memoir A Prayer Before Dawn, is still in the studio with me. Don't go anywhere. Coming up in part three, I'm going to ask him about that book and about you know, how he's come back to, you know, his journey back to the UK and what he thinks of fight sports today. Obviously, it's boom time for fight sports, especially in this city of ours when it comes to martial arts. And I'm sure there's a lesson or two that Billy could teach some of the Liverpool's MMA fighters now on the way up. Don't go anywhere. Fight Disciples. More from us coming next.
You're listening to the Fight Disciples podcast.
Welcome back to Fight Disciples on Radio City Talk. I'm still joined in the studio by Billy Moore, I'm delighted to say. We've talked obviously about Thailand, talked about the Thai fight, and I want to talk to you now, Billy, about coming back to the UK and making that adjustment. You came back to the UK to finish your sentence. Yeah. Was it London you were down at? What was that like? You know, initially coming back to the UK for the first time after spending, how long was it total? 3 years?
Five years
in total,
yeah.
in prison in Thailand.
Yeah.
Suddenly walking into a prison in the UK, even one as notorious as Wandsworth, yeah. It must have took some adjusting.
It was. There was a culture shock. I'd learned this new language, so I was fluent in speaking Thai, and you know, found it difficult to communicate with English prison officers and inmates. And you know, I listened to how ungrateful they were when they were standing in the dinner queue. You know, and they were moaning and whinging, and I thought, you know what, if you just kind of spend a day in this prison, then you'd be grateful for what you've got today, you know. And I went back and I slept on the prison floor in Wandsworth, and he kept saying to me, why don't you get in the bed? And I don't know, I just couldn't do it, because I was that used to kind of like in that position, just kind of, it was like, I think I slept on the floor for about 6 weeks.
Wow.
So I was encouraged by a counsellor who said I possibly had PTSD, to kind of like just make me way into like get back into a bed really and start conditioning yourself to that. It was quite difficult, and the staff there, to be fair, were quite supportive. Like especially the gym staff, you know what I mean? They got me a gym orderly's job. I spent 8 months in Wandsworth, and you know, I just got released. He just come to Michelle about 5 p.m. one evening. I didn't even know what date I was getting released. I had no release date because it was still a Thai inmate. And he just told me I could go. And I was like, standing there with a bag of belongings, rooted to the spot, looking to the left and to the right and going, where do we go from here?
Yeah.
You know, I've just been in this country for 5 years. I've come back. I've been in prison for a long time. And now you're kicking me out the door. And all you give me was the last place I went to. Was the first place I left from, was Bournemouth. They said, where was you before you went to prison in Thailand? I went, Bournemouth. They went, would you like to go back? And I did, okay. Didn't even know anyone there. I had a ticket to Bournemouth, and I remember going there, trying to show us I was a friend that I had in this Paradise Elf Bar, which was a swingers club, which is the last place I knew he'd worked. And I found myself in there at half past 10, the first night. Skinned, asking the staff where this guy Jay was, and he said he's left. He didn't, you know, years ago. And unfortunately, someone had a number for him, and I contacted him, and he picked me up. And you know, it was sad because he was kind of in the grip of addiction, but he kind of hid it well. He disguised it really well. He had a machete, a nice house,
yeah.
But he was ruined. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And being clean and being in around people, places, and things at the time. It's like shitting in a barber shop, you're going to end up getting an haircut the longer you go.
Absolutely,
And staying around people who are using drugs, you know, the longer I did that, you know, the more...
So,
you know, I picked up and I used and, I struggled for a little while. And I remember being in the hospital, almost dead. I was thinking, what's going on here again, man? What's wrong with you? You know, and I phoned my mum. I hadn't seen my mum for about 6 years, and she was sobbing, and she asked me to come home, and, you know, I felt really embarrassed and ashamed, and she never even knew I was using drugs. You know, when I went back, come back to Liverpool, and I just couldn't come out of a bedroom in my mum's little house. You know, felt so angry, and I hated for society and myself. And I just started to write. I couldn't even communicate properly with anyone, so I just started to write about my experiences. And, you know, a book came to fruition out of it.
So at that point in time, you weren't thinking, oh, this is my way out here. I can write a book about my experiences, maybe make some money, maybe start my life, you know, again.
Yeah.
And at the time, it was just like a release. I've just got to get this out.
It was therapeutic for me. And it all started when I was in Wandsworth, because I remember being in a cell with some guy and I couldn't even talk about, or identify with the same stuff, because he hadn't been through that kind of experience. And I remember writing it down and showing it to an education member of the staff, and she went, oh my God, you need to write more, this is brilliant. And I thought she was stroking my ego because she was gorgeous, and I thought, well, all right, you know, as long as you keep coming back, yeah, you know what I mean, I don't mind, I'll write all day longer. But she was quite encouraging of me, and said, you're very descriptive, and, you know, the senses and the feelings, and I'm actually there.
Yeah.
You are a very good writer, and it was nice. I started to feel a little bit more like, really, you know, because I'd never really written anything unless it was a letter trying to blag a family member for a bit of money, you know what I mean? So it continues, and when I got out, I put it on hold because I ended up using drugs again, and then I was in my mum's, and I just sat there one day and I got in front of the computer. I thought, okay, where are you now, Bill? Come on, what's going on? And that kind of, I made a decision then to change my life. And I went into a detox in Liverpool. And that was it. You know, for 5 years, my life was like totally changed. I was in recovery, I was back on form, I was doing really, really well in areas of, like, I was working for the NHS. You know, I was working for an organisation which helped people in drug and alcohol addiction. I was training again, you know, I'd stopped smoking, I was doing all the right things, but there was still that demon was still following me somewhere, you know what I mean? And I knew it, and I had to be vigilant because my mental health was suffering.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think anyone, you know, without passing judgment on people or myself, when you're driven by a substance, you know, you're doing things that you wouldn't normally do, and you find yourself in places that you wouldn't normally go to, and that's what happened. I was diagnosed with cancer after 5 years. You know, and on the outside, you've got this glamorous kind of, like, you've wrote a book, there's a movie, you've got a job, you've got a house, you've got a car, you know, you've got relationships that are positive.
Mm.
You know, and I still felt really lonely. I felt like you could put me in a room full of people and I'd still feel on my own, and it was like, you know. And then he hit me with this cancer diagnosis, and then introduced me back to drugs through no choice of my own. You know, that was an hard one. The medication started to become 2 tablets to 4 tablets,
yeah,
to six to like, you know what, this is not enough. You know what I mean? It was already talking to me and telling me that I needed more, and, you know, part of me was fighting to stop it, but I thought, I'm going to end up dead anyway. So, you know, all that, I was justifying and minimalising and rationalising my behaviour. And I picked up again after 5 years. And like I said, when I pick up drugs, there's a consequence.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And that consequence put me back in a prison where, you know, I missed the cinema release of my own kind of life story that, you know, I'd worked so hard to...
It's your life. It's your life being played out for everybody else to see.
Exactly, yeah.
And so, to not be there.
Yeah, it's like, why is all this kind of like happening? You know what I mean? So, yeah, it was there was a big loss, there was a big consequence, you know, and I'd done something that I didn't want to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was the, you know, the ultimate consequence was ending up back in a prison back in the UK 16 years later. And the last time I was in Welton was, I was on the roof. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was going in, back in recovery by this time, by the way, with a new, like, look on the prison establishments. And for the first time in my life, being compliant and being an observer and seeing, you know, the damage that drugs these days, like the legalised, the spice and that, are doing to people, you know, the mental, the, you know, the paranoid mental health. It was just crazy, to be honest.
The film, obviously, released in Cannes, as I said at the top of the show, incredible. You know, some of the reviews are just mind-blowing. From some of the biggest, you know, establishments out there, Hollywood Reporter, New York Times, you name it, Everybody absolutely raving about it. Did that get fed back to you in prison? Did someone ring you and go, Bill, it's smashed, we're doing brilliant?
Yeah, there was a lot of... you know, there were a lot of people writing to me and friends that were visiting, and I was in touch with their Altitude, who were the UK distributors.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was a good guy there. Hamish, who was constantly in contact with me. You know, he'd send me all the reports, and he'd come and visit, and, you know, he'd tell me how well it was doing, the reviews. And, you know, I didn't even have to be told half the time, because it was all publicised in the papers, you know what I mean? It was in all our national newspapers. It was in all the magazines, like The Empire and that. So I could read about it. And, you know, it was getting 5 stars here. It was getting, you know, and all these magazines were getting really good, great reviews. And I was quite proud.
Absolutely.
I was proud, you know, and of what I'd achieved. And I was like, wow, you know, you made this from nothing. You know what I mean? You were just a crazy mixed up kid in the two-bit sound that took the wrong path. You know, went through a horrendous ordeal. Come out the other side, you've been through, you know, years and years of being incarcerated. You've been through meningitis and, you know, cancer treatments. You know, you've been through many, many breakups, many makeups, many shakeups. You've had, you know, you've had this kind of whirlwind of a life. You've been on the red carpet in Cannes with all these stars and... Still, I just didn't feel like I belonged. It was weird. It was like, you know, you could put me in this room with all... I swear, I remember the first time I sat down with these producers and they were talking about making a movie, and I was like, who's going to star in this, Ken Zod? You're going to make it on Breck Road or what? What's going on here? Are you for real? And I just, like, felt like an adolescent in front of all these people. It was like... No, I wasn't savvy in the industry, in contracts, and I was quite, like, misled in some areas, which, you know, that's what happens.
Yeah,
that's part of it, it's part and parcel. And what I'll do this time round is, with this new book I've written, is, you know, I'll source out an agent, I'll do the right things for myself, because I need taken care of, you know what I mean? That's the truth.
Yeah.
You know, I can take care of myself in the streets and on the landings and, you know, in the ring, but in life... You know, in general, you know, I'm not the greatest kind of caretaker.
So the new book that you're working on, please tell me it's a follow-on.
Yeah.
It is a follow-on?
It's a follow-on. Oh,
tremendous.
It's called Surrender from the Heart, and I spent a year writing it. And for me, when I write, it's like, I write, like, with the most kind of, like, I could be the most honest I can, really, you know what I mean?
I'm
going to write this, like, Bill, tell the truth. Don't lie, you know, if you were scared, be honest, you know what I mean? You know, talk about how you're feeling, talk about the anger that kind of, like, you were experiencing and how you channel that, you know what I mean? And that's what I did this time. It's like, you know, I kind of learned a lot, you know what I mean? And it's more about, like, the journey from Wandsworth up until the present day, you know what I mean?
Do you think, have you tap Joe Cole up as well? Joe Cole, obviously, from Peaky Blinders, who plays you in the film.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's brilliant, by the way.
Yeah,
absolutely. But you must look at it and think, you know, the kid's literally produced the performance of his life there to sell my story as well. Like,
it was great how we got him, because they were, I think Charlie Hunnam was was on board initially, and I was looking at Charlie Hunnam, and you know, I just thought, no, he's not Billy Moore him.
Yeah.
You know, he's got a massive fan base, and the producers are into all that because they want, like, you know, a name to attach to him so he can sell it.
Yeah.
And the director said to me, you know, I like this guy Joe Cole. What do you think of him? And I watched a few things he'd been in, like Offender and Peaky Blinders, and you know, the minute I saw him, he had that 1,000 yard stare, and you know, and I thought, you know what? And the producers were like, nah, well, he's not a name, and you know, the finances mightn't like support us with money because we can't attach him to this. And I was like, look, it's not about money. It's about telling the truth with a great kind of performance, and having it as authentic as possible. So when I met Joe, I knew straight away. You know what I mean? It was going to happen. And he did. He's done like a really, really an amazing, powerful performance. And I've got a lot of love for Joe, and I'm a great friend today. And he's been supportive all the way through.
Yeah.
You know, my journey, and we still maintain that contact, which is after the fact, which is great. You know what I mean? Yeah.
You loving life again?
Yeah, I'm learning to adjust. I'm teaching young kids what I know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a trainer by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, I think what we do as people is like we share our experience with others, and that's what I can do. I can show a few. I'm writing a little bit more. I've got some interviews coming up soon. I'm looking at this agent that's been in touch, so things, you know, hopefully be positive, because, you know, the first question people ask me is, how much did you make out of this movie? And was that scene with the lazy boy real? I'm not making much, and plus, no, it never happened. The director put that, you need to read the book to understand, but you can't do that. There's a bit of, like, factual fiction in there, so.
Will you see out your days with that demon on your shoulder, do you think? Will the demon ever go away?
No, it's something I've got to, I think I've built up more awareness.
Yeah.
I'm a lot more mature. I'm back, you know, I haven't used for a long time now, which is good. And I go to places where I get identification and support. I've got a great network of friends around me now who are quite supportive. You know, when I need to pick up the phone, instead of picking up a substance, then that's what I do.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't keep things to myself. And that's the biggest, you know, problem as people, you know, when we struggle with our feelings and our mental health, you know, the easiest thing to do is pick up a drug or a drink or a woman or something just to change the way we feel. And for me, you know, it's about sitting with it and experiencing it and going, okay, you know, if you can walk through the mud and the nails without using anything to change the way you feel, then, you know, you'll gain more awareness as you go along. And that's what I did. I've just done all the right things this time round. Stay in regular contact with friends.
Brilliant. Listen, thank you so much for coming in. Much appreciated. We missed you last summer, but I was desperate to get you on. Can't wait for the new book to be released. Best of luck with it.
Thank you.
And best of luck with, you know, your future journey, man. Stick with it. And boxing's the salvation, isn't it?
It's the one, lads, yeah.
Absolutely. You listen to Fight Disciples on Radio City Talk. Catch us across social media at Fight Disciples. And for our usual shows this week, two podcasts there, one MMA, one boxing. You'll get that at fightdisciples.com. I'll be back here next week with much more on the Merseyside fight scene.
Thank you for listening. If you like what you heard, subscribe via iTunes.